Session number 8257.
Steve Moyle, Reel 4. You were telling me you used to occasionally sing songs. You remembered one of them.
Oh, yes. We even used to chant a fire, a campfire, when we were down the line. And even though it was beyond observation, my sister would sing song around the campfire at night. Our petty officer of the 8th platoon that I was in, he composed this song. I'll try and give it to you now. Boys of the R&D, lads that the veterans admire, on land and sea they earn their name in the face of the foeman's fire. Boys, some of them may be, but men's work they have done. Where the shells burst around, it is there they'll be found, adding to the laurels they have won. I assure you, I was in pain when I was singing that.
That's very nice of you, thanks. Did you sing any more scurrilous songs, slightly lighter lyrics, or were they all that sort of patriotic pride in regiment song?
Many of them, most of them pretty patriotic. That's probably we sang the popular songs of the day, some of them.
Just to carry on with what we were talking about, the conditions, you know, in the front line. Where did you used to sleep in the trenches?
Oh, you're on the fire step. Yeah.
Just laid out along it, or slumped with your back to the trench wall?
Oh, no, laid along it, Peter. You see, as I was saying earlier on, we were very short of men, and you had plenty of room to lay down without any interference.
Did you have any sort of dugouts or burrowed out holes for yourself or your personal equipment?
Well, we had a dugout for different things, you know. For one lot would be manufactured these bombs out of jam tins, for instance, something like that, you know. And there were a jam tin. I think most of them were done down the line, but they were sealed up with a fuse to the top, and you had a few seconds to light the fuse and throw it the bomb, you know, if necessary. But as we went back, going back to the place where young Richardson was found, he couldn't hear. There was a mortar in the back of this communication trench, and it'd been throwing these bombs out of a catapult. The catapult, not a proper trench mortar. And one, before we took over this part, was called the Worcester Flat. The Worcester's been there, and one of these bombs had struck the top of this high parapet where the periscopic rifle was, and come back down this trench and killed a lot of the men that were using this catapult. It's only a shallow communication trench up to the parapet, and it's quite bloodstained. It's quite a bit of a shock to see that we took over soon after that had happened, you know.
To look at a couple of other things. You say that we've been looking at the sort of conditions in the trenches and things. And what effect did this have on the health of the troops and how tired they were? You say there weren't many men. Were they going sick, or were they casualties?
Well, the trouble was the dysentery, Peter. We had a big lavatory down the camp. And when you went to that lavatory, there was a very shallow, very narrow trench dug with a plank along where you sat on. But the sides of this trench was massive with blood and slime. You see, the men got so bad with dysentery that they couldn't sleep with you at night. They go and sleep by the latrines, which is handy, And in fact, a lot of them, I think, were dying. It seemed to me that you had to be on the last gasp before they sent you off, Peter.
Was there any resentment about that?
Hmm?
Was there any resentment about people not being sent back when they were obviously dying?
Well, the fellows seemed to take things in their stride, you know, the conditions and everything that was going.
Did any men die of dysentery actually in the trenches in your unit? Or?
Oh, no. But, you know, the doctors are down in the camp, and I think that they might have complained in the trenches if they'd had the proper treatment. It may have saved a lot more. But, you know, when you did get treatments, what did they have? They gave you a dose of castor oil to clear it out, and then a dose of chlorodyne to bung you up again. And that was all they had in those days, you know.
Did you actually get dysentery yourself, or were you lucky?
No, I was very lucky, for some reason. I don't think I had the thirst that I witnessed with in my mates. I didn't seem to need so much water. Whether they'd been used to in the pubbies now, I don't know, but anyway. I did get, later on, I did get, when I was a butcher, I got jaundice, yellow eyes, which I didn't go sick, I just went and got medicine. And I was handed to the doctor down at the camp, you know. And that, you see, that's what I'm guessing at, that the men in the trenches, they couldn't get immediate attention. They had to get permission to go down. One chap went down while I was in the camp, and he'd left the reserve trench, one of the reserve trenches. And this is true, but I heard, Peter, this, that when he reported sick at the camp, the doctor said, "Where are you from?" He said, "From the reserve trenches up the Lancer." He said, "Get back up there. Get back up there, or I'll be put in a court martial," he said. He went into a dugout and shot himself. That was the story I heard, Peter.
Did you know the man at all?
I didn't know him. I didn't know anything about him. I just heard that. That was what was.
So, there were a lot of men ill. How did they look when they were ill? With dysentery or whatever, what was the appearance of the men? Did they?
Mentally, they're right down in the dumps, you might as well say. And you see, they stank. That's why they came. That's why they went and slept up by the latrines at night. See, they're incontinent. They couldn't hold it.
What about their physical appearance? How did their illness manifest itself in their sort of faces and their bodies?
Oh, well, they looked terrible.
Were they in any fit condition to fight? The people who, you know, the ones who got this ill?
Many were sent up, you know, after treatment, they were sent back up the line, you know, until such time that they couldn't carry on. And that was all that there was to it.
So, was illness the main reason why you were so short of men and went on this one-hour one-off?
Yeah.
Not actual enemy action casualties?
Not enemy, no. I don't think so at all. I think it's the dysentery and the illness caused by, in my opinion, that water for a start that we were drinking from that well where the body was brought up.
That was very early on?
Yeah. Well, we were working in the trenches when we used to come down the line and use that well. So it must have been, getting on in May.
So, with there being so few men, you mentioned earlier that everyone became extremely tired doing the 1 hour off, 1 hour
on.
Oh,
yes.
I presume you got very tired. You mentioned yourself you'd fallen out of the trench.
I was on watch and doing me 1 hour, and I don't remember anything until suddenly I fell down and let me crash at the bottom of the trench. Rifle and bayonet, you wouldn't kill myself. But I never thought about being hurt. I scrambled back as quick as I could because I knew it. I should have passed a court martial or something.
Were your officers sympathetic to the condition that the sentries were in from
the
tiredness?
Most of them were, but there was one Marine lieutenant, he wasn't so happy about it, you know.
Did you feel tired all the time, or just during the evening sentry duties?
Oh, you're all right with it after the one the night after stand down to arms, you know, from the where he got stand down at daylight, stand to at dusk, and then we got a 4-hour watch before you went on again. You see, so you get a bit of a rest then.
Could you take me through a typical day in the front line? What you'd do from when you stood 2 in the morning to standing down at night? Standing 2 at night. Could you tell me sort of what sort of things you'd do during the day?
Well, there wasn't much to do in the Anglophone either. But if we were down in the camp, for instance, you'd get card parties and all that. I remember one time down at the camp, the governor in Breslau had 2 German battleships that got through to the Dardanelles, you know. They escaped before the landing and got up the towards Constant, which gave the Turks a lot of confidence, more confidence than anything. And the card party, we had 2 trenches to sleep in. I remember the front trench of the 7th platoon, I think. And the Govan, or the Breslau, let go of one of her guns, and the shell landed right in front of this party and showered them, covered them with the soil and what have you. And we dashed it, I was one that dashed up to give him a hand, and we were scratching away like mad, you know, and I said, "Who's buried?" "Oh, it's the bloody cards we're looking for," they said.
But in the front line, what sort of duties would you do during the day? You know, and when would you get your meals, that sort of thing? Can you remember that, during a typical day?
Well, I don't care to put much time on that, Peter. We should just eat when you could do, when the conditions were favourable, you see. Sometimes there'd be a bit of a scare or a sniper or something to deter you. In fact, I remember a sniper. There's a tree in front of our trench, and we had the first time I'd seen an Australian down our end, and the machine gunners, how they got onto our end of the peninsula, I don't know to this day, but they came and took up a duty while they were on the Cape Elizan with their machine gun, and suddenly we realised that there was a sniper in the tree just in front of the trench. And these Aussies got the rubber machine gun on the tree and they brought him down. And he had his face painted green. Aye.
Were there a lot of snipers?
Yeah?
Were there a lot of snipers?
There was at one time, yeah. In fact, you know, the way they stationed them, one day we saw a party of Turks come out with a white flag, purporting to be burying their dead. But when they returned to their own trench, they'd posted snipers in good positions, you know.
They'd left them in no
they'd
man's
left
land.
Left them in different positions. And after that, we had a devil job with them. And that was when Lieutenant Tetley of the Royal Marines decided to take his platoon out and clean them up, you know.
That's when he got there, got...
And that, the people on our left opened fire.
And did you do any sniping yourself, or did...
Oh,
did,
yes.
What did you used to do when you were doing a snipe?
In one position, we had an iron plate, you see. An iron plate and an aperture in the plate big enough to get a rifle through. And I remember sniping one day about 300 yards, the Turkish trench was. And I saw a turban fly off one shot I made. What was it, the parson or what, I couldn't say. which they must have brought down a sniper of their own. And I got a jam on my rifle, you know. And I withdrew the rifle from this aperture and was trying to get the cartridge out. When the sniper put a bullet through that aperture. It was only like that, Peter. About that size.
About 3 or 4 inches square.
Four inches square, but he put a bullet right through that. So I said, right, old boy, you're a better shot than I am. And the officer, one of our officers came on, he says, were you sniping there, Moyle? I said, yes, sir. And he must have seen my face, I think. And he did a bit of a grin and went off. But there's no doubt there's some very keen snipers in the among the Turks. Fine shots, you know.
Did people often get hit, sort of while they were walking along the trench, bits where their head bobbed up above, or was it more that they were hit while they were on sentry duty or while they were sniping
one
themselves?
One case of an officer, I've just lost his name, he was using a periscope looking over the trench, and the sniper hit the glass of the periscope, and it blinded him one eye, I think, and damaged the other. Well, he was back in England when I came home eventually.
You said you used to make bombs. Did you have bombing sets that you used to throw them out of, or was it mainly through this catapult affair, mortar affair?
That was what it was for, I think. We did. I personally never made any. I didn't have to make any jam between bombs, but I used to help on the Mills bombs. Eventually, we got the Mills bombs. You put in a dugout and it's sandbagged up while you fuse them, you see. There's streaming props down there, and if one chap had been windy and made a mistake, you went up with him.
If this was at Gallipoli, you got Mills bombs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we got them later on.
And you could throw them far enough to reach the Turkish trench?
Yeah.
About how far away was the trench then?
Well, it was more for an advance, I think, Peter. You couldn't throw them by 300 yards. And some of the trenches were 300 yards, you know.
Did you get much artillery? Not during an attack, but just during a normal day. Would you get many artillery shells landing near you?
Well, we got a gun on for ladens from the other side of the Dardanelles, the Asiatic side. And I've seen a shell hit earlier on and ricochet right across the peninsula. With a low trajectory, you know, a low trajectory shell from a gun.
So it hit the water and bounced over?
No, it hit the ground, Peter. It was just at the... Being a low trajectory, it hit the ground and ricochet, bounced over, kind of thing. Especially where it was a hammer-piercing shell. I remember seeing once... We went down to bathe one morning, what they called Morto Bay. It was a... just around the corner, up the Dardanelles a bit, in Morto Bay, and the Royal Scots had landed there, I believe. Anyway, we were bathing, in Sarkis, of course, and there was what the fleet reserveman told me, that the ship was the HMS, what the devil was her name? Anyway, she was there trying to find a gun position for the Turks. It must have been in a pit, this gun. And it's brought up, fired, and then lowered down again for loading. But anyway, all of a sudden this ship, I'll think of her name later on, she started to go full astern. And just where she'd been, there was plunk, 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 three shells. He must have spotted it as he glassed on the bridge of this battleship.
Did the support the Royal Navy give, did that make you feel a lot better? Did it give you a moral uplift to see the shells hitting it?
We had quite a lot of support early on from the Navy. Well, as I mentioned before, the Triumph and Majestic were down at the beach. And eventually, the Triumph, she went round up the peninsula and she got sunk there, you know. But I reckon their guns must have been nearly worn out at the time she was sunk. The batteries, they got the sort of shells, so I heard, you know, eventually. Oh yes, we had good support from artillery, there's no doubt about that.
What about the land artillery? Did you feel you had good support from them?
Oh yes. We had the French 75s. They were a good gun, and they seemed to be so easily manhandled, the 75, for loading and that, you know.
Yeah. I'd like to... How did your morale stand up after a fair period of trench warfare and so-called rest periods where you, as you said, you were still under fire?
Yeah.
How did your morale hold up? Did you get a bit nervy being under constant fire, or did you just become...
Well, I suppose it depends on your temperament, but generally, speaking generally, Peter, the men were really good. You never saw anybody in a panic, which they'd take cover if it was... shell or two coming over. There was no panic.
And you shared in this. You yourself were like this as well. You didn't get nervy or about it at all.
Well, I reckon I was a nervous disposition myself when I was a youngster. I just showed what the ordinary reaction to that condition. That's all.
What about your officers and your NCOs? Did they lead you well under fire? Did they?
Oh yes, they were good. In fact, my platoon officer Pollock, last time I heard him, he was a brigadier general, and that was the type. He was an Irish fellow too, isn't it? A Dublin fellow, I believe.
During your rest periods, not that 2 weeks that the doctor got you for, but your normal in and out of the line rest periods, were you put on fatigues or on working parties? Or...
Oh yes, you had to do your turn in working parties. Yeah.
Can you describe to me any sort of working parties you were on, or the sort of things you did if you can't remember an individual occasion?
Well, improving the. Things, you know, generally, Peter. I can't remember any special duties that you did, but there's improvements were made in...
What, in trench lines, or...?
Yes, yeah.
So you'd go up to the front line again and dig, or...?
There may be damage from shell fire and so on that you had to make good.
Did you work on the beaches at all? I know you did when you first landed, but...
No, we didn't do any beach work.
What did you get much chance to go swimming during your rest period?
Oh, yes. We took a chance, too, because, on that beach I was talking about, the Mortar Bay, you were under fire there. You kept yourself clean as you could. And water being so very scarce... When it came to washing, well, we'd have an officer's canvas bucket, and we'd have a bath in that, four or five of us, have a bath in that, and then you'd wash your togs in that, your singlet and underwear.
This is during the rest periods?
Aye. So you can imagine that bucket of water is like this.
You remember anything else about your rest periods? Were you just in trenches again, or any sort of camp?
No, we didn't. Just the usual duties, Peter. Then, aye.
What about contacts with home, with your family and friends?
Oh yes, we got mail, and we could write home in a green envelope. You were told not to mention anything. Where you were, anything like that, but you could, it's like a private envelope.
Did your family know where you were?
I think they must have known, eventually.
Did you get letters from them regularly?
Yes, yeah.
Do you get any parcels?
I used to get one. I used to make my own cigarettes, you know, and I used to get tobacco sent out.
Did the parcels arrive untouched, or were they sometimes a little lighter than
they
were?
Oh, no, they were mostly untouched that I got.
What about the backup services to you? What sort of opinion did you have of them, your cooks and things like that?
Well, eventually we got Field Kitchen, and the cooking was quite good. We got stews and bully stews mostly.
What about the padre, the religion chaplain?
I don't remember seeing a padre on Gallipoli.
Was religion important to you at all while you were at Gallipoli? Was religion important to you at all in getting through this experience, you know, Gallipoli? Were you religious by nature, or did it not bother you?
I think I was a bit religious as a young fella. Strange thoughts used to come to me, you know. Especially when your mates were knocked out and so on, you know. It was very distressing.
And religion helped a bit.
I tell you, quite frankly, that I used to pray, say my prayers many years ago. And I said my prayers when we were waiting after the Collingwood battalion was decimated pretty well. I said my prayers on that parapet, you know, as I leaned on that parapet waiting to go over. I said my prayers.
Did you ever go to any services? Or?
Oh, yes, not in, on Gallipoli.
Not on Gallipoli, though, yeah.
Mm.
Were there any special individuals that you remember from this period in the trenches? You know, any particular pals or officers that inspired you or didn't inspire you?
Oh, yes, there's that lad I was telling you about in particular, the Irish lad who got the bullet in his... He was a character. And as I say, he came back after being operated and get the bullets out. I think it was a Mark 6 bullet. You know, we landed, I told you, with the Longley Enfield rifles and Mark 6 bullets. And the Turks accused us of using dum-dum bullets because the Mark 6 was a round nose bullet. Whereas the Mark 7 using a shortly Enfield was a pointed bullet, which I reckon would our Mark 6 would cause more damage if it was in the head, or a Turk was in the head, than the Mark 7.
When did they change over?
We changed over. It's after that advance we made, because we got the long bayonets, you see. We got the Mark 7 ammunition, shortly Enfield rifles and long bayonets, so that we could use